Democratic socialists are winning elections and gaining momentum, but they're also struggling to define themselves and explain what they actually want. So is democratic socialism just having more libraries? Or is it more like abolishing the Senate, nationalizing industries, and rewriting the Constitution? And with midterm elections coming up, will their far-left ideas backfire? Hello and welcome to the Reason Roundtable. This is your libertarian review of news and culture from the editors of Reason Magazine. I'm your host, Peter Suderman, and today I am joined by my colleagues, Catherine Mengu Ward, Matt Welch, and Nick Gillespie. Catherine, I want to read you a line from a New York Times report this weekend. The report is about the socialist moment, the rise of the Democratic Socialists of America as a political force in like meaningful elections. And this is the line I want you to respond to. Knocking on doors and building energy for elections have tended to be more central to the organization than in the weeds policy analysis. So do you see the DSA as having anything like a clearly defined policy agenda? And if so, is it in any way realistic?
I read the DSA policy agenda manifesto thing this morning because you made me, and the narrative at the beginning.
The manifesto thing, the official name.
The official name of it. And the narrative at the beginning has the same energy as, you know, when you search for a recipe online, but you can't read the recipe. First, you have to read, like, I first tasted plums when I was a girl. Like, you have to, you know, you have to have the little thing at the beginning. It's exactly like that. So there's this, like, portrait of life under the DSA agenda. And it seems to be like, if you like your capitalism, you can keep it. Like, it's like if you had a day off under the DSA, everything would be exactly the same, except for you wouldn't be worried about money and you wouldn't hate your job. That's the promise. That's bonkers. That's crazy. That's a crazy thing to suggest. It's a totally insane to suggest that if it was fully realized, this agenda, which, as you noted, includes things like rewriting the Constitution and abolishing several of the branches of government, that like life would just continue apace, except for with fewer worries. Nonsense. Absolute garbage.
Nick, I know you didn't edit our abolish everything issue, but like you've been the editor of Reason Magazine when we have called for abolishing lots of the government. So is there anything to like about the DSA's call to abolish, I don't know, the Senate?
Let's put it this way. If in fact their reforms led to politics being a smaller part of our everyday life, that would be great. I don't know.
Yeah,
that
but I don't see that happening.
No, no.
Right? I mean, part of the platform is government run, like food, housing, medicine, nationalizing industries. That's government running everything.
Yeah, no.
Where I take issue just real quick with what Catherine said. It's not if you like your capitalism, you can keep it. You can't.
Right.
You just absolutely cannot.
But they're honest about that. But, you know, it's like we already, and I think this is a refrain going back 60 years of Reason nearly, you know, that if you think about health insurance, education, and retirement, those are three of the things that are most screwed up. And they are either extremely regulated or wholly regulated and controlled by the government. And we can throw in housing as well when you look at all of the different regulations and restrictions on housing and the way mortgages are created and all of that kind of stuff. The places where the government is the biggest part of our lives are the worst. That I think is a message that we need to be hammering home more in, you know, that John Stewart interview of Zoran Mamdani, where, and Peter, you were referencing it, where, you know, Mamdani was like, well, you know what socialism is? It's libraries and fire departments. And it's like, it's none of those, right? Or neither of those. And if it was just that, we already know how we get good libraries, and they existed both as private philanthropies as well as private public partnerships, mostly funded in the U.S. By Andrew Carnegie. And fire departments have existed, you know, from antiquity. So it's like we don't need socialism to do that. And then when you start to look at the idea of more and more government being more and more part of your everyday life, where it's like you don't get to make a decision. You've got to go and run it past City Hall or go to the block party and the block watchman and make sure everything's okay. It's bad. But it's also, you know, it's a good advertising slogan, right? Like you'll finally get a day off, because in capitalism, you don't eat if you don't work and nobody has a day off. Nobody has anything. And to the extent that they do, it's because of the shirt waist triangle factory fire and the reforms that came out of that over 100 years ago. And it's just
every day is a day off when you work at Reason. Matt, it's like obviously crazy town, a lot of this stuff. And there is an effort, you know, I think from Republicans to play up some of the crazier aspects of the Democratic Socialist agenda. But we're also seeing this on the left, where centrist Democrats, people like Rahm Emanuel, taking to the Wall Street Journal to warn that the Bernie bros are going to cost Democrats the next election and that they're going to get a bunch of Republicans elected. How much do you buy that? Like, I mean, is this a plausible thing that is going to happen, that these people are going to seem way too extreme, way too far left, way too progressive, and that it's going to end up helping the forces of MAGA?
I mean, it certainly energizes. It's one of the only things that energizes Republicans in the year of our Lord 2026 is that the DSA exists. And thanks to Mom Donnie flexing his muscles, now has a tiny little bit of entry into the Congress. And so it's a national politics story kind of for the first time, and with the possibility of gaining a couple of seats in November. It's a very small national story. It's a very large national discourse thing, partly juiced by Republicans. And we are choosing to begin our podcast talking about the DSA and not for the first time. So clearly it's a item of interest and it's growing. And so therefore it is interesting. Then anytime there's something new in politics, everyone is relieved and wants to talk about it. But yes, there's absolute opportunism, and it's a way to change the subject from the fact that the person running the federal government is making one colossal blunder after another and engaging in the type of corruption we've never seen before. So I think the way that it's an interesting national story is mostly about the the pull that the DSA left and the overlapping left that isn't necessarily self-identified as DSA, maybe the larger Bernie bro audience, will continue to pull at the Democratic Party. I'll give you one anecdote. Had the misfortune of interviewing Chris Murphy a couple of weeks ago, and for the Fifth Column
podcast.
Was
it worse for you or for him?
Yes. And we asked.
As somebody who watched it, I'll say it was worse for the audience.
Thank you.
Thanks, Nick. As a compliment to the Fifth Column, Matt.
We asked him, well, what about the government owning grocery stores? And this person who's in the United States Senate and so therefore and on book tour and therefore supposed to be able to talk, if nothing else, he's like, I don't know. I'm not really from New York, so maybe I'm not really sure. That gives us a sense of where we're at. So the center of gravity is being pulled in the direction so that milquetoast Democrats are a little bit terrified to be against the government running grocery stores. That's the way in which this is the most interesting. It still is not quite as interesting as the fact that Donald Trump is the president of the United States and doing weird things.
Yeah. With the Republican Party backing him, 90 to 95%. I mean, think about it. He went hammer and tongs after Tom Massie in Kentucky, and Massie, was advertising that he voted with Trump like 90 or 91% of the time.
Same with Dan Crenshaw.
The Republican Party is really in, they're near bankruptcy. So they want to focus on the DSA stuff. Peter, I think a huge part of this is also the generational aspect. Like when the DSA or when people say it's about going out and knocking on doors, that's the one thing that somebody like Andrew Cuomo didn't do. Andrew Cuomo is a lead weight. He's an anchor on the Democratic Party, the mainstream Democratic Party that failed to beat Trump twice in a row, that failed to convert majorities in the Congress into anything ultimately meaningful or lasting. They are out of energy. They don't get out and knock on doors. They expect everything to come their way. And I think what you're seeing is, the beginning of younger millennials and Gen Z flexing their power, and they are going to be entranced by people who speak their language, who say something like, oh, you know what? Like, you work so hard under capitalism and your fucking life sucks. And that's gonna land with most people in their 20s, even if they're doing really well. And that's the energy that's behind it more than the specific policies, which almost to an instance, you can say, yeah, this is really bad. this is a bad policy and it's been tried within the past 20 years and it flopped. But it's that energy. And I think it's mostly generational.
Yeah, to speak to Matt's point, I mean, we're going to talk about some of the ways that Trump is flailing a little later on this podcast. And last week, I wrote a piece kind of connecting the DSA's policy nihilism and their just insistence on doing stuff that has been tried and doesn't work, doesn't produce the effects that, you know, that its bill is having, it doesn't work the way it's supposed to, over and over again. Rent control. In New York, we've been trying it for 50 years or more. And look what the rent is like in New York right now. Tariffs, Donald Trump. Right? Like tariffs do not, there's a whole shirt with a slogan that's basically like, they don't do the thing that they're supposed to do. They also don't do anything else that anybody wants to do. It doesn't work. It's a bad idea. I think there is like a real embrace of just idiot policy or no policy at all on both the left and the right now. But before we sort of move on to some of the policy specifics, Catherine, I want to ask you about something that Matt brought up here, which is just, this is a bunch of partisan factional infighting. And at Reason, we don't sort of care that much about what the parties are doing and how they're positioning themselves politically, right? Like, so how much do we like care in some ways about whether Chris Murphy is unable to say that government-run grocery stores are bad or like that the DSA is out there recruiting candidates completely outside of the major Democratic Party apparatus?
Yeah, I mean, I think as I'm following the rise of the DSA to the extent that it is rising, like the thing that seems the most interesting to me is this is a roadmap. This is a case study for ideologically wacky outsiders potentially hijacking a major party. And that's relevant to me because I'm an ideologically wacky outsider who would potentially like to hijack a major party. I'm taking notes. And I think that in many ways they took notes on the Tea Party, which was the last time this happened on the other side. You know, we've written articles at Reason about the parallels between the kind of DSA types and kind of libertarian types within the Republican Party. And, you know, so I'm sensitive to the fact that, like, yes, if I wrote out my full agenda for things, it would look like the abolish everything issue. It would look like this DSA manifesto. It would sound crazy to most people and they would not like it. And they would enjoy freaking out about it. And we are enjoying freaking out about the DSA. And they're winning a couple of elections. So, you know, I think for listeners to this podcast who maybe tend to a slightly more radical or outsider view on certain political issues, maybe the most interesting thing about the DSA is not that mainstream Democrats hate it and feel grumpy about it. It's that they feel a little beholden to it. And so how can we do that for our thing?
How can we do that for our thing? Let's talk a little bit more about their specific things. Maybe that will give us some ideas, Catherine. You can add to your notebook here. Medicare for all, $25 minimum wage, and then a new one to me. We're getting every single worker in a union. That's Claire Valdez, who is, I guess, wants to have a federal policy for absolutely every American, at least who wants to be unionized. Nick. Is this at all a realistic idea? And I take it you don't think it's a good one.
I may not think it's a good idea, but I have filed the paperwork to start a writer's union at Reason. So I guess
I'm
I shouldn't be.
Insert jokes here that I cannot make because the National Labor Relations Board might actually come after me, which, by the way, that is ridiculous.
Making the smiley face and not saying anything.
We've talked about Claire Valdez a couple times on the show. She represents literally the most left-wing congressional district in America. And so she probably, most of the people who voted for her overwhelmingly in every demographic group in the Democratic primary this last go around is probably saying, you know what, that's not good enough. It's got to be mandatory and things like that. It's a bad idea. People should be free to join whatever groups they want to or not. And again, this goes to the, like, it's not, I don't think that the DSA is only popular among downwardly mobile young elites, but this is their policy agenda is a young person's policy agenda that is unburdened with history or lived experience. For the reasons, Peter, that you were kind of suggesting that, like, you know, rent control doesn't work because rent control got jacked up in 2019 in New York and rent now sucks more than it ever did. Obamacare, since Obamacare passed, we're spending more as a percentage of GDP on healthcare. Like, does anybody really think that, oh, making Medicare for all is going to bring that down? It's not. But again, if you're new to this and you're kind of like, fuck it, why don't we try something different? And you can be J.D. Vance on the right, or you can be Zora Mamdani on the left and be like, oh, well, I'm a smart guy. And whatever Milton Friedman was talking about, that might have made sense in the 1980s or the 1970s or the 1800s. But we're in a different world now. So all the past is no longer relevant, except, for Che Guevara. That's where this is headed.
I mean, but what drives me crazy is they're not trying something different. They're trying stuff. They are talking about trying stuff.
It's new
that
to them.
Has been attempted many times and has
it's
never,
new to
ever
them.
Worked.
It's vintage shopping. You know, when you buy something in a vintage store, it's not used clothing. It's new to me clothing. That's what the policy is.
They're buying policy on the real. Matt, speaking of people policies that have maybe not worked so well before, Lina Khan, the former director of Joe Biden's FTC. She's a big antitrust hawk. And last week, Zoran Mamdani put Lina Khan in charge of New York's Economic Development Corporation. Basically, she's going to be his business czar, which is kind of funny because by all indications, she doesn't really like big business. So what do you think of Mamdani's choice here? Does it matter? Or is this maybe a good outcome because she's now stuck in a little tiny agency that doesn't matter at all?
I don't play those games. It's a troll, what Mamdani is doing. He's a pretty gifted social media troll. And he's put a celebrity, an Elizabeth Warren protege celebrity on the left into a position and said, see? And he did this right after doing a really super minor deregulation that many of us like about ice cream, soft serve cones or whatever. And so he can say
frozen yogurt now. All the kids are into frozen yogurt. Ice cream's over.
Yes, that is true. 16 paddles or whatever the hell it's called. Handles.
16 handles.
16 paddles.
16 paddles.
Like
Matt.
Having Bill Blazejowski moment
you're
here.
Having a, you're having
a chapter from 50 Shades
moment,
of Grey.
You are
it's called
having a
in
Gucci
the ice cream
Gong
maker.
Moment.
That the thing in the middle is called a paddle. I feel like Matt's legit here.
Thank you, Catherine. No, it's a bad idea for New York City, a city that I unfortunately live in, but thankfully Nick does too. She's not going to be good for economic development in New York. She's someone who likes to regulate and prevent big businesses from coming in. If you enjoyed, the AOC coalition preventing Amazon from opening up a huge warehouse, you'll enjoy Lina Khan. And she goes up against some of the only good things about Mamdani is that occasionally he's understood about the overregulation of small businesses. I don't think she's seen a regulation and overregulation she didn't like, but maybe I'm wrong. But ultimately, it matters mostly for New York and for the continued sort of national optics of what is a local story. Semicolon, would just like to point out, and this is pursuant to your point, Peter, that there are a whole bunch of different polities in this country that are governed as if by democratic socialists, people who have very little daylight between their own professed agendas and what they ran on and won and what the DSA did. They don't have the branding of the DSA and they're not sexy and good on social media. But Chicago still exists, my people. It's been run. It's got 50 aldermen. Not one is a Republican. Brandon Johnson is probably the least popular mayor in the United States, and deservedly so. It is an absolute train wreck of a city and a big, important American city. It's run horribly. And a lot of those ideas are DSA playbook plus just normal teachers unions and public sector unions driving everyone into the dirt. It gets a fraction of the attention, as do a couple of backbench Congress critters who will be elected in November. And it shouldn't, because that's where those practical ideas are going right now and creating horrible outcomes.
Catherine, I want to close this section with a quote from the Journal, since we started with a quote from the New York Times here. that Graham Platner was recruited outside of the party apparatus. The Democratic Party wasn't involved in sort of putting him sort of at front and center Maine politics. It was just sort of these independent candidate consultants who were going around recruiting people based on, you know, sort of, do they check a certain type number of boxes, right? Do they look the part, basically? And there's a report in the Wall Street Journal just a couple of months ago on one of these consultants who said, and the journal's quote is that he wants his candidates to back Medicare for all and characterize the Israel-Hamas conflict as a genocide, but beyond that, doesn't believe voters care about detailed proposals. What do you think of that, like, in a bunch of ways? Do voters actually care about the policy details, and does that matter? Why are they completely obsessed with Israel and Medicare for All, which didn't even work? Okay, it wasn't technically Medicare for All, but didn't even work in Vermont, in Bernie Sanders' home state, when they tried it, for the most obvious reason possible, which is it was too expensive for Vermont.
Not to be the guy that's still talking about virtue signaling, but I guess I am the guy who's still talking about virtue signaling, and I'm sorry. That is a good test for a certain type of person, but it's not a good test because of the substance of the test. It's a good test because Medicare for All and using the word genocide are the correct level of signaling for a kind of tribal commitment that is the tribe that these consultants belong to and that they want the candidates to belong to, too. It could be anything. It could be anything that has a slightly high cost by being slightly outside of the mainstream of the major parties. And so I think it's they're panning for gold. It's those two things are just a filter to filter out normies. And it doesn't matter what they are. And no one's going to do Medicare for All, actually. And also, you know, the question of what a single congressman or a mayor of New York City thinks about, you know, Israel is not actually going to be central to what happens in the world. Eventually, yes, it could snowball all these things. Like both of these policies could become more salient and more real. But right now they're not. It's just a filter for a kind of tribal membership.
So it's like when libertarians joke about heroin being legal in vending machines?
It's just who will build the roads, heroin and vending machines.
In charter schools.
Right. Like, it's just a way of filtering for a kind of ideological radicalism. And if I were a consultant looking for candidates, I would also be looking for a simple, you know, two-factor filter. It doesn't mean that's what's going to happen if these people get power.
If I may, though, just to really drag this dead horse of generational signaling, it's important that it's Medicare for All, and especially Israel is committing genocide, because, you know, Republicans are constantly saying that the Democrats hate Israel, et cetera. You know, they don't believe in the rapture or something like that. In fact, the Democratic establishment is totally involved, you know, is totally pro-Israel. But it's older people, and there's a lot of people on the right, and I'm thinking of people like J.D. Vance and others who are being contorted by, they're saying our foreign policy does not work. The foreign policy of old people like Donald Trump and Joe Biden, George W. Bush, and even Barack Obama, and it was this flex and this expansionist thing, and it was slavishly being obedient to whatever Israel wanted. And I think it vastly overstates the influence of Israel and the salience of Israel in our foreign policy. Like, all of our presidents have fucked it up on their own, and our Congress and things like that. But that is signaling to younger people. We are not going to do what our parents and our grandparents and our great-grandparents, who are still fucking in office, like Susan Collins, are doing. And I think the Medicare for All, the switcheroo there for young people is like, why are old people getting free Medicaid, medical insurance, health insurance, unlimited stuff? Why don't we get it? We're the ones who are suffering, not rich old people. So I agree with you, Catherine. These are two issues. They're like face tattoos, right? And you got to have them to show you're part of the gang. You can't cover it up. But it's also important that they are hearkening to, you know, we are not going to be like our parents or grandparents or great grandparents.
Except for they're not. They don't even have the full commitment of the face tattoo. It's just like some extra piercings.
Yeah.
Because you can just take them out and everyone's going to.
Right. It's a clip-on, septum piercing
that
you can take off.
It's hair dye at best. And I say that fully understanding. Like, it's reversible signaling that's acting like it's a face tattoo or cutting your pinky off or whatever. And it's just not.
Medicare for All will wash out eventually. So one other thing I just want to add here is that the New York Times piece that we started with talked about how the DSA in New York, it's rising, but they don't really know what they want. But one thing that they are focused on is tax the rich. Now, there's not a lot of details. It's not like a specific policy or a specific bill that they've attached that to, but they want to raise taxes on the wealthy, maybe some high earners, especially in New York. And they are going to pressure their Democratic governor to do that. And I think that is one place where they might actually make an impact on policy in big blue states like New York, Massachusetts, and California, is raising taxes on high earners and on wealthy people. And that is actually going to matter. And they might might cash out to, that's what the DSA gets. Okay, let's move on. Catherine, you want to go?
They need to do the tax the rich thing because they can't actually do the Marxist thing anymore. Like there's not a distinction between workers and capitalists, but they need a distinction of the good guys and the bad guys. And so the rich is the closest they can get. And of course, it doesn't work. Like the underlying Marxian mechanisms don't work if it's just people who happen to have a lot of money who are the bad guys. We can leave it there, though.
All right, let's move on to our inevitable and necessary Iran check-in. Okay. It seems like Donald Trump is pressing pause on what was a planned big escalation in strikes because we don't have enough missile interceptors. So what do we think here? Is this good, Nick? I mean, is Trump basically just taking the off-ramp like we talked about a couple of weeks ago on this pod where he's just, you know what? You can just not bomb Iran. And maybe he's just not going to.
Maybe. You know, we'll see. I mean, I think a lot of it depends now because it's the early part of the week, right? So, like, we're pausing stuff. I saw him, I guess, was it at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, the redo of that, where it was like, Iran really wants to make a deal, but they're not just ready yet to make a really good deal. You know, he's going to keep stringing this along until he can ignore it and forget about it. But it's a total disaster. And again, in keeping with the, you know, the generational stuff, you know, when the soldiers who were killed, you know, last week, like come home and it's like one of them's a 19-year-old Latina. It's like, yeah, you know what, Trump, you are helping the DSA, you know, win votes because they're like, yeah, you know what, whatever we do, we're not going to be sending, you know, sub 20 people who can't even vote, or I guess you can vote at 18. And if you're illegal, obviously you get 6 or 7 votes, right? According to the right. But like, we're not going to be sending young people to die in wars that we shouldn't be in the first place.
Matt, did you see the exchange that went around between NBC's Kristen Welker and Mike Waltz, who's the ambassador to the UN, in which Waltz said that the reason that we've run out of interceptors is because they've been depleted because of President Biden. Mm-hmm. And then Welker responds, but you acknowledge they're depleted. And then Walt says, no. So he just said they're depleted because of Biden. And then he's saying, no, they're not depleted. And then he follows up with, and the people leaking this nonsense deserve to be in jail.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So
welcome to
America. We have
America,
a First Amendment,
everyone.
Right? Where you can report on things.
Yeah, we do. Still, it's a lot of hard work to keep it there. But there are some of us who are involved in that work.
Well, there's the other amendments that are kind of holding it up, right? The other 20 something.
There's a detail in the book Regime Change by Maggie Haberman and Jonathan Swan, which I will be recommending later in this podcast, that sticks with me. And it's that Marco Rubio, Secretary of State, and whatever, president of the National Archives, whatever his jobs are, and memer in chief, he doesn't really go on foreign visits very much. And why? Because he wants to be as close to the White House as possible. And why? Because he wants to be the guy in the room with Donald Trump. Because what the policy is, and that the lackey Mike Waltz non-entities have to go out and attempt to justify on television, the policy is whatever Donald Trump has most recently truth socialed. That's where people find things out. Yesterday, he was truth socialing, from what I understand, listening on the radio, that I use AI slop about us taking Karg Island. So that was the American policy 17 hours ago. And now it's this zag and that zig. And it's, you know, it's necessary to talk about ongoing national calamities and international calamities that are hysterically unpopular, underwater by 70 percentage points of independents and 45 percentage points of just all Americans. Like, it's really, really bad. But also tracing the through line of it, there isn't any. It is whatever Trump thinks about on a whim in, at this moment. And that's a really, really bad way to exert foreign policy or any type of policy. It makes America a very erratic place and an unreliable partner. And we're sowing the seeds of all of that. We can't get international cooperation for things that we want to do geopolitically, in large part because of this type of behavior.
Catherine, we got a listener question from Lee that I wanted to ask you about here. This is not our formal official listener question of the week, but I thought it was an interesting query for us, right? So Lee writes, I don't see much difference between Iran's behavior in the Strait of Hormuz and the Somali pirates from a decade ago. Are we supposed to let them attack every ship that doesn't pay their toll? If the USA won't defend free trade, who will? And so is there a case at this point for continuing with some version of this war in order to defend free trade? And I will just note that Donald Trump announced his new tariff regime last Friday.
Yeah, it would be cool if someone was defending free trade, but that isn't really what's happening. We also, I think there was a point, I don't know, it's hard to remember now, where the U.S. was itself maybe going to impose a fee on or a tariff or a tax or something on
about 12 hours
traffic toll. Through the toll through the Strait of Hormuz. It's almost like there isn't at base a fundamental distinction between bands of pirates, tyrannical regimes, and also just regular old countries. And it's almost like taxation is theft is a thought that I have had. That's not helpful. I know. And I don't need to ride that hobby horse into the sunset again. But yes, all of these mechanisms in which people extract money from people who are just trying to do trade around the world are bad. And defending a world in which there is freer trade, if not free trade, would be good. It's just not anyone's, like, no one
but
is actually in that business.
With our, and pretending, with our bullets that we don't have, right, but we definitely do. And if I say that we don't have them, I'm going to jail.
Right. The U.S. is pretending at this moment in that place to be in the business of defending free trade, sort of, for right now. But that is a very different thing than what would it look like to work to build the institutions and the agreements and the norms that establish free trade around the world. And Trump has taken a big dent out of that, as have the leaders of Iran, as did the pirates.
All right. Speaking of norms, let's move on to our actual official listener question, which is about movies and the philosophy of liberalism. Before we get to the actual question, a reminder, we always love to answer your questions. So please send your short, succinct, pithy, and otherwise not very long questions to podcasts@reason.com. That is podcasts@reason.com. And thank you, as always, for putting the words listener question in the subject line. Actually, lots of good questions this week. We won't be able to get to all of them, but we're just going to read one from Justin, and it is about the Odyssey and liberalism's self-defense mechanisms. So Justin writes, I saw the Odyssey this weekend, Peter, and your review crystallized what I thought Nolan was trying to say. The Trojan horse works because people still honor norms like hospitality and trust. But by violating those norms to win the war, Odysseus helps weaken the civilization he is trying to save. That made me think about something that Nick often celebrates. We've never been freer to live the lives we individually want. So if liberalism stays neutral about the good life, where do the virtues that make liberty possible come from? And once those norms start eroding, because people see them as obstacles to achieving good ends, what resources does liberalism have to restore them? Does liberalism have any resources for rebuilding them, or is it just dependent on moral capital accumulated in earlier generations? Catherine, I know you saw the Odyssey for the first time this weekend. We talked a little bit about it last week. You want to answer this question about a movie you just saw and libertarian philosophy?
I do. First of all, I think Stephanie Slade secretly wrote this question. That's my theory, because, of course, she has a book length answer to this question that is coming out in early September. And that is fusionism, the idea that freedom is dependent on virtue and vice versa. You can't have one without the other. I have always sort of instinctively, and I think also with some reason, resisted this idea that liberalism is functioning only on the fumes of some kind of Judeo-Christian morality or something like that. And we're all doomed. I don't think that's the case. I think there are many, many sources of virtue and energy and order, and that it needn't be just this one that we happen to know worked in the past. I did see The Odyssey this weekend. My first and most important note is I startled out of my chair so many times during this movie because it was so loud and things kept jumping out from behind things. Like I left that movie with my cortisol levels through the roof, but I also really liked it. The lesson of this movie is norms. The lesson of this movie is you violate the norms, you get into a low trust society, and then everything falls apart. The sea people's theory, which I forget if we talked about it last week, but this idea of like what is the truth of these ravaging sea peoples who are going to bring about the collapse of civilization as we know it? Maybe the sea peoples are really us. All of that is in there. It's all good. None of that's in The Odyssey, friends. And so I guess that is something that I just want to say is like Odysseus as a character is ancient and strange and feels none of the feelings that Christopher Nolan feels. And I think I liked the movie and also thought, like, I would like to see a movie with the Odysseus of the Odyssey in it, because that guy is coming home triumphant. He's proud of his wiles. He thinks he's entitled to adventure, and he is not looking at a doomed civilization with darkness in his heart. It's just not where he is. And I'm not there either. So I'm with strange and ancient Odysseus, not with modern and sad Christopher Nolan Odysseus.
Emily Wilson, the supposedly, and I emphasize supposedly, woke translator, also made the exact same complaint as you did about the movie.
I didn't know that, but I love her, and I agree.
This isn't a modern version.
But now you got to get a bunch of tattoos.
Oh, no.
She's tatted up like she was in prison.
Don't make me get a bunch of cool tattoos like Emily Wilson's. Tell me about a complicated man. She's right. That's a good opening line.
Nick, you're a complicated man. Yeah. And your name was invoked in this
question. Nobody understands me except my woman and Matt Welch. Mm-hmm. It's a basic
And the
fact.
Blind poet.
Yeah, blind poet.
It's redundant, but yes.
He was just trying to get cheap coffee. Homer, big liar. the one thing
actually
that I wanted to
true.
Address. Yeah, though, he's obviously, right? And also, do we, if we're going to go back to ancient civilizations, I think we have more to learn from Rome, which was a republic and became an empire. And Rome is the historical antecedent that haunted the founding fathers and should haunt us more than anything that happened in Greek mythology or history. But to go to the reader's question, one of the things, and this builds on something Catherine was saying, liberalism doesn't destroy authority or undermine it. Or tradition, it decentralizes and deregulates it so that people have more to choose from. And that doesn't mean, good society, the good society goes away. I mean, we are so much more profoundly a better country now than we were 50 years ago or 100 years ago when you think about virtually any morality. On a regular level, we commit fewer crimes. Men and women are more equal. We don't have the kind of institutionalized either de jure or de facto segregation in virtually all aspects of our country. We have a lot of problems, and they need to be fixed. We have rotting institutions, particularly government institutions, that need to be rehabbed. But the fact of the matter is as society loosened up from a so-called Judeo-Christian basis and really go back to the 50s and start to look at when Judeo gets tacked on to Christian, because it's not there in the 19th century, et cetera. It's a term of political convenience after World War II. But so we didn't become more horrible as a society. We've become better as a society. And more people have the options to be more fulfilled. We're bringing our morality with us. And when we look at how other subcultures and other affinity societies in our culture are going, we learn what works and what doesn't. So I think the idea that liberalism liberalism ultimately, and you know, the way we're talking about our classical liberalism and libertarianism, years, decades ago, 30 years ago, I likened it to an operating system, you know, for a computer, where the whole point of it is that it broadly structures things. And as long as things are voluntary and as long as the applications that you want to launch don't crash the system, go at it. And you have more autonomy than you ever had to build what you want to do. But if you crash the system, if you commit fraud, if you commit crime, if you're violent, if you refuse to allow other people to have the equal rights that you have, then, you know, something has to change. You have to be restrained. That's, you know, in what way are we saying we're a less moral society than we were, you know, when I was a kid or, you know, when my parents were a kid?
Matt, I picked this question obviously because it's about a movie, but also because this is something you hear a lot. That people, it is an argument that people make. People feel like the norms that held us together are breaking down, that things are different now and they're worse. What do you think?
I'm worried about that very much. And I really like this. I like this question, not least for its implied insult to Nick Gillespie. But I think there is a sense that one can feel all around you that certain norms that you maybe particularly like, not even norms, just like habits. You know, I was at the Baseball Hall of Fame induction ceremony this past weekend, which is great, wonderful, highly recommend, 10 out of 10 as usual. And every year it's fewer people show up. And you can just sort of see, like, you know, you're not going outside, people, as much as you should. And baseball is more popular than it has been in a long time right now. And that's all to the good. But just like going out and doing stuff, all of the, you know, the little leagues and churches and all that happy stuff that I've belabored over the years as sort of withering away, that requires work to make it happen. All that said, there's a line in the question which I think ultimately undermines the thesis, which is that liberalism is neutral. Liberalism is not neutral. You know, the greatest document of liberalism, arguably, is the Declaration of Independence and its life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That is a very interesting and radical and ennobling line. It's we assume that we need to pursue happiness. What did Jefferson do as a third act in his life? And he had some pretty, you know, the opening salvo, not bad, some decent diplomacy here and there. Actually was the president, did Louisiana Purchase. What was he most proud of? It was founding the University of Virginia, because he, like many of the founders, were obsessed with this question. They wanted to help try to inculcate a virtue in the new republic that they had created, and to have the spirit of 1776 live on in succeeding generations. Many of them who became disillusioned with the revolution, which was almost every single founding father who survived into the 19th century, this was their one of their leading causes for that disillusionment, along with slavery, was that the country was not being as virtuous as they wanted to. Their ideas about this expanded man was not adhering as much to the democracy that they had created. It's a constant struggle. But I don't think that the liberalism itself, well, whether through Adam Smith and theory of moral sentiments and et cetera, I don't think it is. Free markets are aggressively non-neutral. They are virtuous, and they help create the virtue that we continue to benefit from in all the ways that Nick talked about.
I know I'm late to the game, but can I also just say I did really like Christopher Nolan's Calypso as the psychedelics therapist for the veteran with PTSD. Top tier stuff. Great reimagining. Like, I would not have thought of that. And I thought it was great. Like, you weren't ready to remember. I had to wait. I had to help you here. Eat your lotus leaves. Oops. I gave you a little bit too much lotus.
My and bad. It was the also peptides. Good for me.
More peptides. More, yeah. Well, I've it, seen yeah. her referred to as Calypso. Which I think is great. But also, Catherine, and I know you have an interest in psychedelics as well. Again, you know, psychedelic scenes are now, trip scenes are now the crazy 100%. New York taxicab drive ride in the 1980s
movie. The training
montage
is now a trip scene in every movie. And absolutely. I, for one, am here for it. When they're coming out of the Trojan horse and the entire soundtrack is his own heartbeat, it's so good. It's so good.
So speaking of the lotus and things you want to ingest that maybe aren't entirely entirely approved by the federal government. Let's talk about peptides. Also about the good life. I think these things are kind of connected. So last week, a Food and Drug Administration advisory panel recommended broader use of six peptides. The New York Times, in their lead on this, calls them unproven peptides. This recommendation is not binding, but it's usually acted upon. Nick, this is obviously a win for personal liberty, right? It's great. Like, this is what we want. And we want to see not just this, but more of this.
Yeah, I'm actually very happy about this because it is, you know, and we need to bracket it that this is an advisory board. Its rulings are non-binding, all of this kind of stuff. And people should really inform themselves about whatever drugs, whatever substances, whatever foods they're taking, because there's a lot of room for, you know, flimflammery and just bullshit and things like that. But this is a good thing. I mean, we know that the FDA is one of the least efficient regulatory bodies out there. It does a good job of keeping things that are going to definitely kill people off the shelves. But in doing that, it also keeps a ton of other stuff, including experimental cures that may or may not work, especially when they scale up. It keeps those out of reach of people. I think this is a good thing. This is, you know, one of the few things that Trump was good on in his first term when he signed right to die legislation or right to try legislation for people who are about to die. I think this is a good thing. We should all be more responsible for living in a world where we have more options in what we ingest for whatever reason we want to ingest them. We don't need the government involved. That doesn't make it easier. In many ways, that makes it harder for individuals. But it's absolutely right. If we want to live in a freer society, we should have more access to more things like peptides.
Catherine, I realize I'm just making you respond to quotes in the New York Times today, but you did work there. So if it's anybody's responsibility, it's yours. Right. So the lead sentence for the New York Times report on this first calls the peptides that are being recommended for broader use unproven, and then follows up by saying that the recommendation raises concerns that wellness and telehealth companies could adopt a once obscure pathway to bringing unapproved drugs to the commercial market. Should we be concerned about this?
No, I'm that dude in the meme. I'm like, good. Yeah. No, I think the...
Yes,
I think the,
it's exactly right.
In the same piece, a little bit further down, actually, I love it when they quote the people saying the quiet part loud. And the piece quotes John Hertig, who is a pharmacist and the board chair of the Collaborative for Evidence-Based Medicines, which is some kind of advocacy group. And he says, listen, if we let this happen, if it gets listed in this way, and compounding pharmacies can make it and people can prescribe it through the telemedicine path, once it's on the list, you lose control. That's the quote. And it's like, he didn't say once it's on the list, people might die. He didn't say, he said, you lose control. And who's the you here? Well, he kind of means we lose control, where we is the powers that be, the gatekeepers and ultimately the state. So I'm all for that. Lose control. I don't like you being in charge of what I get to inject into my person. But aside from the grumpy libertarianism, I do think like this is, this is something where the control can't hold. Like, we do live in this kind of increasingly interconnected and also increasingly loophole-ridden world. And so people who are highly motivated will find ways, and they always have. But if this happens to be the newest semi-licit loophole that lets people try these medicines, it's just one of a long line.
Matt, to tie this all together, I want to try a theory on you. We talked earlier about Medicare for All just being a signaling mechanism for DSA and DSA curious types. But Medicare for All is a signaling mechanism in part because there is a widespread feeling in America that the healthcare system, the whole thing, is too complicated, too expensive, doesn't really work, doesn't really provide what people want for patients. And all of these loopholes, all of these sort of ways of getting maybe unauthorized peptides And a bunch of other stuff that people are finding in the last couple of years, especially post-COVID, especially sort of after what we saw, with the mask off moment with the public health establishment. People are just looking for ways to get out of that system any way they can. And the peptides craze is part of that. And it actually seems to me to point to, like, to not a perfect world, not one where we fix the problem in a really big way, but where we maybe just like fix little bits of the problem, you know, sort of at the margins, and people just can have the healthcare and can have the kind of body management, the chemistry management of themselves and their bodies that they want, that they think works for them, without the people who are in the middle who just want control. Like, is that what this is about?
I think what you're trying to say is that people are Medicare for all in the streets, but they're for free market peptides in the sheets. Something along those lines.
Thank you, Matt. That's it.
That makes sense. I just would say to those who think the Medicare for all is the solution to the problem that they feel acutely, the limiting of choice is what happens in top-down healthcare provision systems by definition. That's what it is. So you no peptides for you if that's what it decides. And I think that in the sheets, most Americans do experience and participate actively in medical freemen. Freedom, that's the word. and freemen. And so there's some tensions that people need to work through.
All right, let's move on to our final segment, cultural recommendations. Movies, TV, books, games, and other cultural detritus that we have been consuming and would like to tell you about, perhaps recommend, perhaps not. Catherine, do you want to start us off?
Yes. I read Pale Fire by Vladimir Nabokov. It's a fresh new book from the 60s, and it is really good. I don't know if you know about this Vladimir Nabokov fellow. He's quite a good writer.
How'd you pronounce
and
that?
And nobody knows how to pronounce his name.
Yeah.
Nabokov. I don't know.
The police solved this. Sting solved this for us.
Okay.
Oh, that so, police? I figured it was like the Czechoslovakian. Yeah.
So here is the thing. I really love this book. I read this in college when I took a Russian literature course and have not thought about it or read it since, but my book club read it. And upon reread, so this is one of those classic, the book is all form. So it's a poem in the style of Alexander Pope, which is itself embedded in commentary, which is written by maybe a madman after the death of the author of the poem. There are footnotes that lead you through clues. There's an imaginary Russian kingdom called Zembla. There's just a lot going on. And what this book did was make me hate David Foster Wallace more. I already hated David Foster Wallace a lot. I want to be clear. So there was some confirmation bias here. But it does the thing that David Foster Wallace is trying to do. But first of all, it does it 1,000 times better. And second, it does it with joy. It's just this book is very, very fun to read. It's like this wacky, weird thing. Nabokov is coming off of the success of Lolita, and he just writes this bonkers book that's about the impossibility of knowing things and the foolishness of criticism and the inevitability of death and whether or not art can survive the artist. And he just does it like, let me just see if I can pull this off. This is going to be fun. And it
so
is
it's not
fun.
Just 900 pages about how television is deadening our senses.
It's all like, hey, maybe life is full of joy and weirdness. And even when things are bad, they're kind of good and interesting. And you can do that in a complicated series of footnotes if you want to, just for added difficulty. Like the poem itself, which is just the core of this thing, is also good. Like Nabokov just casually is like, and by the way, here's a poem in the style of Alexander Pope that's actually in rhyming couplets and is very formal and it's better than anything else you can write. And I'm just doing this as the basis of my whole other project that I'm doing here. Delightful. Very, very fun. If you are ever thinking about reading David Foster Wallace, don't do that. Read Pale Fire instead.
I did not realize that this was going to be
sweaty, women-hating suicides, Catherine. Besides a 1,000-page novel that you almost certainly were forced to read at various
Also,
points.
Pale Fire, not that long. Yeah. Shorter, does all the things. way fewer pages.
You're just mad about the bandana. Matt, did you also read a good book?
Matt likes the bandana. Matt used to wear bandanas.
Swear, used to.
Yeah.
I have one right there. This I can weekend. Put on right now.
Yeah.
I read a very good and useful book, not in the same way as Pale Fire. There's no tome poems in it, as far as I know. But Regime Change, aforementioned by Jonathan Swan and Maggie Haberman, Inside the Imperial Presidency of Donald Trump, or something close to that, in the subtitle. Huge book, gigantic bestseller. It operates, it's basically like if you've ever read a Bob Woodward book about the White House in a certain period of time, it's like that. I don't mean
but
that as
more believable.
I don't mean that as an insult. I have my problems with Bob Woodward, which we've probably talked about in the past. But like, you know, they interview 1,000 people. They have a little note on sources at the beginning and saying we only use quotes when it comes directly from one of the persons or from notes or in some ways and whatever. They go through it and it's a TikTok of the first year of Donald Trump's second administration and all the kind of incredible velocity and insanity with Liberation Day, basically going all the way up through the beginning of the war in Iran. So it is on that level very interesting and useful for journalists and future historians and such. It just is in a lot of rooms or is depicting a lot of rooms where these decisions are being made. And on the broader level, it is, it's kind of interested in the idea of power. It's about the accumulation of power and how much more power there is in Trump's second administration in the presidency than there was in the first, and the mechanisms by which they did that and the ways that they've exercised that. It's just very, a very useful book. And what I appreciated about it was that there was almost no belaboring the point or throat clearing. If they had to talk about something, let's say it was about January 6th or some big contested thing, which you could definitely spend 75 paragraphs saying, well, some people said about this and some people said this and whatever. It's just kind of a tangential point, and they want to assert that the election was legit and the people were bananas who did this and let's kind of move on. They just do it in a paragraph. They don't do a lot of on one hand, on the others. They make the assertion, but they also don't do the showboaty, very Trump first term habit, journalistic habit of like, can you believe that? My God, do you see what they're doing there? They indulge in almost none of that, which is great. It's much more reportorial and just a lot of fun tidbits like the Marco Rubio one. Trump is out there like super gluing gold fixtures inside the White House, apparently. the corruption stuff is off the charts. Just Stephen Miller, an incredibly odious human being who tried to get rid of habeas corpus, as Jacob Solomon has written about, diligently for reason. But also just, you know, in a meeting with random executives, like oil executives, saying, okay, we want to green light projects, but there have to be projects that start producing results during this presidency or else we're not interested in them. Like, it's just, everything is incredibly blatant. So it's a very, very useful book, professionally done, and highly recommend Regime Change. Do it today. You'll be glad you did.
Matt, can I ask you, and your interview with Maggie Haberman on the Fifth Column is wonderful and fantastic. Is there an indication what happens, you know, in Trump's first term, he had a Republican Congress for the first 2 years, got everything he wanted, and then lost the congressional majority. Is there any sense of what happens when that happens again this time? Like, do they prognosticate about how he's going to respond to losing control of Congress?
I mean, he's just playing defense against the subpoenas and the impeachments. It's the assumption. They're not really, the book's timeline cuts off basically in March of this year. So the midterms are coming into view, but they don't spend a lot of time on it. And they don't do a lot of prognostication in general, but it's just very clear that he's pretty mono-focused on trying to avoid the calamity that the midterms are going to provide and I presume more than is in the book, that it's just going to be an incredible preemptive pardon palooza of everybody that's ever been near him. To try to sidestep the inevitable prosecutions that are coming their way.
So getting a Trump pardon will be like the new Epstein files. Like if you don't get a pardon from Trump, you're really not part of Washington.
That's right.
Elites.
You're not an insider.
Yeah.
It's going to be like the deficit. There's going to be trillions of them and we'll lose count. All right. So I watched a, yeah. uh, uh, a television show about the CIA. It's called The Agency. It's on its second season. It's on Paramount Plus, and it is surprisingly good. It's by Jez and Henry Butterworth, who are these kind of weird theater guys who've been hopping in and out of Hollywood for a while, but it has just an incredible cast. Michael Fassbender, Jeffrey Wright, John McGarro, and Richard Gere, who you don't see on screen very much anymore because of the whole Tibet and China thing and Hollywood's foray into international markets. But here he is in a show that is about how kind of a, like, it's mostly just about American and British spying, but how it works across the world and the toll that it takes on individual humans. And this is the kind of the show's point is every time these people are doing something to run a mission, it's going to hurt the people who are doing it, and it's not going to be effective. And so it's just about the way that there's all of this kind of spy machinations always happening all around us, and it's miserable and it's ineffective, but we keep doing it anyway and patting ourselves on the back for it. And yet everybody involved is compromised, and it's all sort of a moral black hole. It is just a fantastic bit of sort of a spy thriller drama. If you like tightly plotted thrillers, you know, in the Jean Le Carré mold, but this is, it's more modern. It's less kind of, I don't know, it doesn't have that Le Carré depression to it. Instead, it's kind of angry about what spying has done to the world and to individual people. And it is just fantastically acted. Like I said, Richard Gere in particular, he is not the lead, but every time you see him on screen, you're just like, damn, what a shame. He should have been a leading man in two movies a year for the last 20 years. And here he is, fourth or fifth billed on a television show. Strongly recommend The Agency season 2 on Paramount Plus. Nick, what do you have for us?
Just very quickly on the Richard Gere front, he's currently filming a version of Asymmetry, where he plays the Philip Roth character. And it's produced by Edward Zwick and Marshall Herskovitz. And that is the movie that I'm most looking forward to, which will be out, I don't know, you know, either later this year or probably next year. It's the role that will cap his entire career, I think.
Sounds perfect. Can't wait.
Yeah, I mean, really, really. Gere is one of the most fascinating fixtures of Hollywood for all sorts of reasons. I watched,
and that Obsession book is great. If anybody doesn't know it, yeah, it's just look it up. It's fantastic.
Yeah, it was a huge success. I think I talked about it on this whenever it came out, like 3 or 4 years ago. I watched Obsession, which just started streaming on Peacock, the horror movie by Curry Barker. That is, it gets a lot of ink because it costs about, the reported budget is $750,000. But it's grossed $450 billion worldwide. And it
million.
Is, yeah, a million. Yeah, I'm sorry. Billion would be even better, right?
Yeah. It's not,
I don't know why I'd be talking to you.
Government program level money.
It's trillion. Yeah, zillion. Thank you for that correction. And but it is, it's about a young, 20-something guy who uses this old thing from the 80s, which seems kind of relevant, to make a wish, and he wants a girl who kind of has friend-zoned him to love him more than anyone else in the world. And then it becomes a study in how his wish goes wrong, both for her and for him. And it's an extremely well-done horror movie. It's claustrophobic. It takes place in a kind of shadow world, which is contemporary, but not anywhere in particular. Lots of scenes of cars, people in cars where the windows have misted over, and you know something from somewhere is going to come up on that car, really, or happen inside the car. I found it very compelling, very interesting. And it's also been getting likened a lot to Fatal Attraction. And it's kind of interesting to think about that as a classic late 80s movie about an obsessive relationship, which was, you know, when we go back to the question about, like, are we a better or a worse country now? Fatal Attraction is a movie which is completely from the male point of view, where Michael Douglas is a piece of shit who then, who has random sex with a woman who then demands his attention in a way he doesn't want to give it. The director of that, they actually filmed the original ending, and they had to change it because the audience rejected it, because the Michael Douglas character got what he deserved at the end. And it's interesting to think about Obsession in relation to something like Fatal Attraction, because it is not that the guy is an incel or he's a terrible person, but he makes the wrong wishes when it comes to relationships. And also the woman who becomes obsessed is also terrifying and scary. It's a much more balanced and nuanced and interesting movie. So I recommend it.
Yeah, it's great. It's one of the two big sort of small movie success stories of the summer. And along with Backrooms, which we talked about on this pod, I just think it shows you that if you take those two movies on the one hand and then The Odyssey on the other hand, it shows you the two paths out of the malaise that Hollywood has been in. And I just think like those movies along with The Odyssey, just giant scale stuff that you can't, right, that only you can only do with a $1 zillion budget or little tiny sort of pinpoint attacks on like the anxieties of the modern age. Are like that's what we're going to see. And that's what's going to take us out of like this, you know, a decade and a half of superhero movies that have just become increasingly sort of like, do I have
and
to go see
say
this?
That even as one? We have a Spider-Man movie in the near horizon.
And guess what I'm going to talk about on this
Avengers.
Pod?
Yeah.
It guess is what I'm going to talk about on this pod next Monday. Speaking of which, we should wait till next Monday. You want to go one more before we?
I just wanted to say, you know, this has always been a tension in Hollywood, but especially since the 70s, as independent movies became more possible to be made, and starting with things like Easy Rider is often seen as one of the starting points because it was made for a few a few hundred thousand dollars and then made a huge amount of money. It did not work out for most of the creative team on that project, but it birthed an independent cinema that can do things that can get distributed now. And I think the most interesting thing, and this is not Curry Barker's first movie, but like, where is he going to be in a few years? And like, does Hollywood absorb all of this creative independent talent and blandize it? Or will we continue to have a very, very rich and varied kind of film industry that is not necessarily tied to Hollywood or big budgets or anything that we're expecting? I hope not. I think the distribution frameworks are in place where we're just going to have more and more fascinating stuff to watch. And it's just going to be harder and harder to keep up.
It's going to be like Peptides. The big producers, yeah. Hollywood, they're going to lose control.
You watch them at your own, you have to do your own research.
All right, that is our show. Thank you so much for listening. If you like what we do, if you like this podcast or everything we do at Reason, you can support us at reason.com/donate. That is reason.com/donate. Reason Roundtable will return.